The Christmas season is upon us, and there's altruism lingering about. We've bought lots of gifts, and we have good feelings and chests poked out. We give to the needy gifts like food and sweaters, but have we overlooked the arrogance of perceiving someone is needy just so we can feel better? Let's explore the Christmas spirit on this week's edition of Frank Relationships. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Frank Relationships with Frank Love.
Frank Love.
Frank Love.
Frank Love.
Frank Love.
Oh yeah. Once again, those are my babies. As always, thanks for getting me started today. Mwah. That's from Daddy. Welcome to Frank Relationships, where we provide a candid, fresh, and frank look into relationships with goals of acceptance, respect, and flexibility. I'm Frank Love, and you can find me, my blog, and my various social media incarnations at franklove.com. Once again, I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. Gail. She's my right hand, my in-house psychological guru, and she thinks she can check me. We'll see if she can keep me scoreless today. What's up, Dr. Gail?
What's up, Frank?
The Christmas season is upon us, and in the disinterest of being labeled a Scrooge, I've waited until after the holiday to challenge our thinking about charity and giving. I was recently talking to a very, very close friend about the holiday. He makes it a point of taking his son with him to go visit a person or family that's less fortunate on the 25th of December each year. I admire the spirit with which he does this, and his comment got me to thinking, is it a bit arrogant or demeaning to think that someone is less fortunate than you are? Sure. When we see someone on the street panhandling, we feel that it's safe to believe that they're not as well off as we are. But if we find out the panhandler is perfectly healthy, lives in a nice home, and panhandles in order to make a living, we probably will feel taken advantage of. Well, a wise person once told me that an honest man cannot be cheated. So, if you would feel that way, I'm talking to you. Is it possible that the actual homeless person that we give money to has a life that's better than ours? Could he revel in or appreciate not having to go to work each day to pay a mortgage and keep up with the Joneses? And if the reveling does not occur, could a valuable gift to them being an encouraging word that tells how their circumstance could be viewed as a blessing instead of money that may inspire them or help them to get the stuff that we have? I don't know the answers. I'm just asking the questions. Our guest today is a clinical psychologist, and he's here to help excavate the issues pertaining to charity, altruism, and the Christmas spirit. So, if you want to hang out as we discuss what we're teaching our children through Christmas, as it's often celebrated, whether it's arrogant to call someone else less fortunate, and the value of giving, even to those that you may perceive as having more than you, then join me in welcoming Dr. George Stallings, and let's get this party started.
Thanks for having me on your show.
You are very welcome. Thanks for joining us. I can remember some years ago watching a young man who was about to get married. He was talking to a woman that was 20, 30 years older than him, and she offered him the opportunity to have his wedding at her house, and he felt insulted. Now, I don't think that she meant anything negative by it, but his attitude was, why would I want to have my wedding at your house? I've got family. I've got places I can have it without relying on you. What makes you think that you're doing me a favor or your house is so special? Was he justified in feeling slighted that she would think that that was a actual kind offer? Or was it a slight to him, like, you don't have anything better? You can do it at my place.
You know, in my view, it sounds like the issue may be more with the young man. If someone did something out of the kindness of their heart, then to me, I personally wouldn't see an issue with it. I think that type of thought probably more reflects what's going on internally with the person receiving the kind offer, because he could have just as easily have declined it and said, you know, it's not something that I really need, but I appreciate the gesture. To me, I don't see anything that's wrong with that type of act.
I actually think that's what he did do. But he just shared his inner thoughts with me. Now,
yeah,
go on.
So, you know, again, I think and sometimes in the society that we live in, because we see so many acts that may be portrayed that somebody is saying this, but really there's some type of underlying negative intention, because on a daily basis, we're just inundated with so much negative information and negative experiences. I think to a certain degree, it becomes, you know, like indoctrinated into our psyche, and we have a tendency maybe to see things that may be negative when necessarily they really may not be.
And also, I think that due to the society we live in, people may perceive it as, well, what do they want out of it? They're doing something nice for me, so they must want me to do something nice in return for them. This can't just be genuinely from, you know, their heart.
Sure. I would agree with that.
Now, Dr. Stallings, you're a psychologist, clinical psychologist. You got a job and all that good stuff. Young man walks up to you with a bag of groceries and gives it to you. How do you receive that?
Well, you know, if a person walked up to me and handed me a bag of groceries, I'm probably say, hey, thank you very much. I appreciate that. And I would take it and I would look into it and see what was had. I would accept the offer for what it was. But also, it depends upon, you know, some things are situational also. If somebody comes running down the street in a hurry and a man holds a bag for me, right, you know, then I may look at it somewhat differently. But oftentimes, the situation that we're in is going to give us social cues how to respond to that given situation. But
which is an act of... Well, that's a lead-in to another conversation I recently had. I was talking to the same buddy that I mentioned earlier that takes his son on to visit someone he considers less fortunate on the 25th of December each year. Talking to him, and he said he would give his last $5 to someone who had less than him. And I asked him, would he give his last $5 to someone that had more than him? And he looked at me like I was crazy and said no. And I said, why? He said, because they don't need it. And I said, how do you know that? And he said he wouldn't be sure, but the mere fact that they had $5 is enough of a reason for him not to give it to him. Where do you fall? What are your thoughts on the concept of giving to everybody, not just those who are less fortunate, which is the actual definition of charity? It's one of the definitions of charity, giving to those who are less fortunate.
Okay. Now, to me, I'm thinking, now, what do we mean by less fortunate? I have $100,000, you have $80,000. Does that make the other person less fortunate?
I was thinking the exact same thing.
So how do we determine who is less fortunate? And to me, the way that I look at it is this. You know, human beings, we're social creatures. And unless you have an antisocial personality disorder or some type of other mental illness where you lack the ability of empathy, when you cannot look at a person's face and determine that they're in some degree of distress or stress, when we as people see that, that gives us a cue. Oftentimes when we see people suffering, I think instinctively many people have a tendency you want to somehow alleviate that suffering. So when we perceive someone to be, if we say, less fortunate, we are perceiving, I believe, a degree of stress or distress within that individual, and we do what we innately do. Our goal is to help alleviate that type of stress.
Interesting. So we're not really slighting the person by giving to them or perceiving them as less fortunate. You think that it's basically us being compassionate.
Yeah, I think it's really, I think it's empathy, it's being passionate. I mean, just this weekend, I had an experience within my house, in the basement, you know, with all the rain that we've had, the sump pump stopped working. And so a neighbor came over, and he came in, he asked me about the sump pump, we were talking about it, went downstairs, removed the sump pump, came back, went to the store, got a float valve and installed it in it. Didn't want anything for the labor or anything whatsoever. He was like, "Hey, you know what? Just give me the money for the float valve," and that was it. To me, that was an act of kindness. The person did this while we were just having a general conversation. I mentioned it. The person was worked as like a very good at doing home improvement. He went downstairs, he fixed it. Didn't want anything for it whatsoever. So I think we see acts of kindness all the time, but sometimes it's up to the individual receiving that act of kindness, how they perceive it. It's not so much about what the person is giving to them. The person doesn't have to have some type of underlying, some type of Machiavellian intentions to harm or gain something. It's up to the person who's receiving it, how they're going to perceive the general act.
Right, I agree. And I think it's a reciprocal effect as well. The person receiving the act of kindness, they benefit from it. But at the other hand, the person that's given, it's kind of like fulfilling a need for them too. You know, I want to help them. It makes me feel good that I'm helping them out. So it kind of goes hand in hand.
Well, sure, and absolutely. And I think that behavior is, if you looked at it from like evolutionary psychology, you know, being altruistic, it has a survival instinct to it, because if people have to survive together, we have to cooperate. If something happened to you, one day I came along and I gave to you, then eventually something may happen to me, and then you would be there to help support me.
Mm-hmm.
So I think altruism is grounded in evolution in human beings. It helps to bring about the survival. It helps to foster the survival of the mechanism of the humans. Just think, if people were not altruistic, if people were just always out for themselves, what would that look like? We would have absolute chaos. No one would care for anybody. If you became injured and you went to the hospital, you wouldn't have anybody there, from like the person driving the ambulance to the person in the waiting room taking information to the doctor that's going to treat you. I think you would see the social fabric slowly start to break down.
Well, I don't know about that. As I look at everybody that you just noted, the ambulance driver, the physician, they all receive a paycheck.
But at the heart of that, Frank, although they receive a paycheck, Dr. Solins receives a paycheck for the work he does. I receive a paycheck for the work I do. At the heart of that, these are people in helping professions. So you have to have a desire to want to help someone in order to be in this profession.
Absolutely right. I agree 100%. Because everybody receives a paycheck. We live in a capitalistic society, so we all have to work. But you could have chosen any number of a thousand of other fields to go into to earn that paycheck. Absolutely.
And it's kind of like, I'm going to, you know, the ultimate is to want to go to work where it seems like, you know, I'm not really working. So you want a job where you enjoy what you're doing. I enjoy the work that I do, helping people, working with people, working with individuals. So although these people in helping professions, they receive a paycheck, it's kind of like, I love what I'm doing, so I'm going to help others to help themselves.
And let's face it, all of us who work in the helping profession, some days you get the paycheck, and it's like, you know what, all the money in the world is not always worth going through this, but day after day we continue to do it.
Right.
I can't think of one profession that cannot be relegated to helping people. I can't think of one, so I don't see where you all's
argument
holds up.
Well, directly, okay. I agree. Like the man outside that's fixing the light pole, yes, he's helping us. At the same time, directly helping someone, like a medical doctor, being a surgeon, a psychologist, you know, working on the ambulance, in my view, that is a direct reflection of my work helping you, or in essence, helping to help yourself.
Well,
that's like a false argument, because all the jobs, all the professions that we're going to have, for some reason, are going to be condoned by society because they are beneficial. So all professions that we have, yes, they're going to be helping at some level, but they help to varying degrees. Just like you can have a public worker, he's outside, he's putting like asphalt in a pothole, then somebody may not see that as a huge value. But if your car was to drive into that, you did some damage, you would see the value in it. For the professions where society do not sanction them, they're somewhat illegal, and we're not going to see things like that flourish. Like we have an underground economy, like we have an underground drug market. This is not sanctioned, but yes, it's still something that takes place in society.
Well, those, the underground market also brings value to people. When you think about drugs, the reason drugs sell is because, meaning narcotics, well, any kind of drug, the reason that they sell is because someone is benefiting from them. The argument could be made, and I'm not saying I'm making it, but the argument could be made that they're bringing value. You could say the same thing with prostitution. You could say the same thing with any of the commerce that occurs on the black market.
Well, I think, to me, if we talk specifically about the drug trade, the value that's being made is a purely economic value, because the person is out selling a addictive product to a captive audience, and that's where the value comes in. It's simply economic. But now, conversely, look at the negative impact that it's going to have on family, it's going to have on society, mental health, physical health. The negative impact is far greater than that small economic value that one person or several people may get from that activity.
Well, how do we measure that? I mean, when we, if a physician very well could be estranged from their spouse, not deal with their children because they're constantly working at the hospital, one could say that they are taking away from the value or the fabric of society. If you wanted to, that argument could be made. It could be made on each side. How do you measure it?
Well, you know, I think for all of us, we probably struggle with the whole thing of, and not just doctors, everybody probably struggles with trying to balance your career and family, you know, having enough time to go to work and then having enough time to spend with your wife and children. I think that's like a universal issue. Mm-hmm. But to me, the way that I measure that is you have to look at, you know, the level of distress or stress that the individuals may be feeling. You know, what is the quality of the life for the individual that's involved? And I think that's an important piece. You have to look at the quality of the life that that person is experiencing.
Hmm. And let me be clear. The reason I wanted us to go down this road had more to do with the concept that we're doing it for the good. And in many ways, in this culture that we live in, we attempt to whittle everything down to dollars. Even charity, you know, charity could be whittled down into money, whether it be an in-kind gift. People are able to get receipts for items that they donate, that you take over to your tax man, that sort of thing. We do tend to whittle things down to dollars. And so with that being the case, we often are removing the simple good that comes from doing whatever it is that feels good.
Well, I'm not clear on, because if there is a dollar amount associated with behavior, that somehow that takes away from it. Because if we're living in an environment, like let's say if you take charitable giving, if a person needs something and money is the only way that they're going to get it, how is providing money, how is that a negative aspect?
I'm not saying that money's the only way that they can get it. I don't.
Okay.
Well, for instance, my church, we do a giving campaign, and so we donated in order to provide housing and shelter for families that were, quote unquote, less fortunate and needed housing, you know, needed these utilities and needed clothing and things of that nature. We had to raise money. So then a dollar value was attached to that. But at the end of the day, that dollar value that was attached to it helped a family. And so the people that gave, they felt good by giving their money to help a family. It wasn't that you were giving because you felt like, oh, let's help these poor people that are less fortunate and, you know, they're going to be on the streets if I don't help them. It was like, no, let's help so this family can have housing and have shelter.
Yeah. It's like also some of the major acts of altruism that I see aren't necessarily tied to money. Just recently, this weekend, I was watching a news broadcast, and I believe it was in New York or New Jersey, I'm not quite sure, where this woman was in this water and she was drowning. And a bunch of people were standing along the pier, and they were watching out of nowhere. I believe this is a policeman or a firefighter. He comes down. He comes down to the pier. He hands someone his utility belt, and without thinking, he plunges into the water, and he swims out, and he rescues this woman. So I think we see all types of acts where people are trying to help each other, where people donate blood. People can donate blood every single day. You have no idea who that blood is going to go to. The only thing you get sometimes is like some orange juice or a cookie at that particular moment, but you're giving of yourself, and you're often not expecting anything back. So I think money isn't the only form of where we're trying to help people, but it's just one of them.
Right. And then on a larger scale that money isn't attached to it, though, the teacher that shielded her children or her classroom
Absolutely.
Kids, you know, mm-hmm. from the firemen, most recently. So she wasn't going to gain any type of monetary value. In fact, she lost her own life due to that. But that is an act of altruism. And, you know, who knows why she did it. She did it, I don't think, so she could have, like, you know, her name attached to, oh, she's a savior. No, she did it out of, you know, that was her instinct. That's what she wanted to do at that time, to help these children.
Now,
yeah, I agree.
I don't want my comment to seem insensitive at all. It's just really opening up the conversation. But it could be said that teacher did what she did because she believed that that is what a responsible adult does. That's what a teacher who is put in that situation or a parent would do, because that is how she self-defines, that to do anything less would mean that she was not who she perceived herself to be.
Yeah, I agree. And I think when you look at altruism, I think when many people who do things out of a truly altruistic act, they're doing it for exact that reason, because that's part of who their core personality is. And this is something that goes along with my core identity. Mm-hmm. It may not mm-hmm. be something that you're going to do just because you're going to feel like you're going to get some type of personal benefit or praise from it, but it's at the core of who you are as a person, absolutely.
Right.
Let's look at the billionaires of the world, the million and billionaires, 100 millionaires. Look back at the Rockefellers and currently at the Gates and the Jobs, not the Jobs as in employment, the Jobs as in the person.
We got it.
When we look at them, there are numerous stories of each of them and billionaires crushing competition, you know, particularly when it gets to be antitrust and monopolies and things like that get brought by the Justice Department. These very people find themselves being oh so charitable after they have crushed so many their competition.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that type of charity and whether we get to the point sometimes where we're being charitable because we don't have anybody else to fight.
Well, you know, to me, it all depends on how we want to look at that. On one level, we can look at it from, say, like an economic point of view, because we all know that when you make that type of money, when you have that type of money, you're going to need some deductions. So mm-hmm. oftentimes, if you're giving away money to charity, and many times you can get like a large write-off for that. But at the same time, can we also make the argument that these people truly do have some type of something within them that they want to still help society overall? Mm-hmm. I'll take an example of that is the Bill and Melinda Gates Society, where they have several foundations which are designed for medicine, for the treatment of diseases, for treatment of education and technology.
Malaria.
Where they give away their malaria. They give away hundreds of millions of dollars every year.
Mm-hmm.
But is their giving any less because they're billionaires as opposed to someone who's giving and you only have like a couple of $1,000s?
Mm-hmm.
And if you do, I believe if you do look at their giving as, or you try to, I guess, let's see how their giving is, or why are they giving, what's the reason behind their giving, I think that's just as bad. The person that's questioning their motives for giving, I think that's just as bad, you know.
But what is it about us that we're going to question, you know, a motive for somebody being altruistic? What does that say about us as individuals and also about society also?
I think the component where it gets interesting is not so much when we're questioning others, it's when we question ourselves. When we look at why we're doing something and take a close examination, am I giving now because I don't have anyone else to fight and I really don't have anything else to do? Or am I just simply giving?
It kind of goes back to what was stated a moment ago. At the core of a person, if that's who you are, that's who you are. You're going to give just because. Just because it's Thursday, I felt like giving, you know, $5 to the guy on the corner. Or I felt like giving this bag of clothes away. And on the flip side of it, I could hold on to these things. And that's a different type of person. But instead, I'm going to choose to give it.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think when we look at giving the act itself, when we look at, like, again, just social learning, we look at the holiday and giving, oftentimes people say that the holidays, they come along and they become too commercialized. It's just not about the spirit anymore. But with social learning about parents getting their children and letting them see that this is how the particular season or this time of the year, these are some of the things that as a society that we get together and do. But I believe hopefully what that can do is that can teach children themselves that you give to other people and they don't have to be less fortunate. We can give to family members, and we're giving the family members, they're not less fortunate always, but this is what you do. This is what one of the things that binds society together is you look out for each other.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Frank Relationships, and we're talking with clinical psychologist Dr. George Stallings about the alternate side of giving. I'm glad that you said you made your last comment, because it takes us right into where I want us to go, and that's, what are we teaching our children right now on Christmas when we're lavishing them with gifts?
I don't know. I think, again, to me, what we're teaching our children, I think if it's done in a responsible manner, you give your child gifts. But I think also one of the practices that I do is not only will I allow my child a gift, but now they have to pick one gift that they are also going to give to someone else. And by them learning to give someone else and see the family practice the same behavior, that can become indoctrinated into their society as they grow. But at the same time, information and things that we teach children, it has to be age appropriate. So when we teach them and we educate them into things, it has to be at the age in which the child can understand and handle that information.
And it also has to be ongoing. It can't just be
absolutely
at Christmas time, this is the only time we're going to give. We're going to give throughout the year. And, you know, not just at Christmas time are we going to give a gift away when we get a gift, but throughout the year are we going to give one gift away when we get one?
Would it be?
I'm sorry.
Go on, Doc.
You know, I think that when it comes to giving, I agree with you 100%. It becomes a way of life. It becomes, a part of who you are. It's not just something that you do on a one time of the year, but when it becomes truly a part of your psyche, when it becomes a part of who you are as a person, I think that's when it starts making the difference. And, you know, just doing little things, like sometimes we've all had the experience where you could be driving in your car, someone puts their signal light on, and you let them in. And then when they don't wave, they say, thank you. How do we handle that? Yeah, it's like, you know what? If I knew you weren't going to wave, I wouldn't have let you in. So sometimes we expect some type of reciprocity for our behavior.
Or
but
thank you.
We expect some type of thank you. But if we do things and it becomes a norm, and if you don't expect something back from it, then I think that's what makes one of the important differences about giving. If you're able to give of yourself and you don't always expect anything back, that's the great part.
All right.
Would it be age appropriate not to give your child a gift on Christmas?
I think when it comes to family and it comes to society and it comes to lots of different religious practices, different families have lots of different ways of handling it. I know of some families who are not Christian or not Catholic. They don't believe in anything about Christmas, so they may wait till the day after to give the child a gift, and maybe not on that particular day. But to me, I don't think that there's any particular damage if it's done correctly and the child has been socialized and educated, that it creates any damage by if a person doesn't believe in that tradition to not celebrate it.
Well, What about, I mean, that the day after Christmas is Kwanzaa. Is it Kwanzaa for that family?
Well, some families may not be religious whatsoever, mm-hmm. and it may not be associated with the religious holiday, but it could be associated more with the season and the period of giving.
And just culturally, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And what is the message that we're sending our children if we decide that we are not going to give them a gift on Christmas? What might be the message? I'm sure every family is a little different.
You know, I think in the context in which it takes place, if leading up to the holiday, a discussion is happening with the child, hey, well, you know, people are celebrating Christmas, but this is something that we as a family, we do not do that. And this does not mean that mommy and daddy doesn't love you any less. And if the child is still receiving love and care and, you know, everything that they need throughout the year, I think that the impact would be negligible.
I completely agree. And and that's something that has to start, you know, early on. As you continue to speak about social learning theory. That starts early on with parents modeling and through their own behavior for the children. You can't just, you know, at five, if the child's been getting gifts all, you know, all along, and then at five, you're like,
right,
we're not going to do gifts this year. Then, you know, it becomes, well, why? What's wrong? Why aren't we going to get gifts any longer? But to, you know, be a part of their fabric of their lives, you know, ongoing, so that from as early as on as they can remember or understand.
Yes, yes. You know, I think one of the things that I've seen, I've actually experienced people who they've celebrated Christmas their entire life, and now they get to a certain age and they have children, and then they decide to convert from one religion to the next, and now all of a sudden for this Christmas holiday, we're no longer going to celebrate Christmas. And something like that can pose somewhat of a dilemma for the child, because children may not always understand, well, you changed from this and now you're looking at things this way, so why does that impact how I'm going to be treated? So again, I think it depends on the context. You have to have conversations. You have to lay the groundwork for these types of things. You just can't, like, do it haphazardly.
What is a message that is not age-appropriate concerning Christmas or the holidays for a child?
I think some of the things that I think are not age-appropriate, I have a biased perspective, and I see sometimes...
What's your bias?
Tendency. Well, my bias is I've seen too many parents, in my experience, will say, I don't lie to my child about anything. I always tell my child the truth. And they will do exactly that. They will just talk to their child and give their child information the same way they would an adult. Like, hey, we're not going to celebrate Christmas. Christmas is just a day about corporations making money. People don't love you, so we're not going to celebrate that. If mommy wants to give it to you or daddy will give it to you, we'll give it to you because we want to, not because it's Christmas. Okay? That is something too much for a child to understand. That's just too much. And in situations like that, when you have people who will give and just talk, I'm sorry, when you have people who will just give information without censoring it, I think that's from a psychological standpoint, it works out great. Because now, by me telling you what I have to feel, I've unburdened myself, and now it's your responsibility to deal with that information.
Give me the censored version.
The censored version?
Or the age-appropriate version?
Well, I think that the age-appropriate version, I think an age-appropriate version would be something like, you know what, again, you know, if Tony, I understand the holidays are coming around, you know, you're going to see many people putting up a Christmas trees and lights, but that's not a tradition that we follow in this family. You know, mommy and daddy, we're going to do things differently because you may not get gifts on this day. It doesn't mean that mommy and daddy doesn't love you any more or any less. We still love you, but we're going to do something a little bit later.
And even with that, I believe that you can celebrate without, you know, going overboard with the gift given either. You know, one or two gifts and explain that this is a tradition that we're going to have in our family and still celebrate Christmas however you choose to celebrate is just as fine, because as a child, you don't know. Like, you don't know the difference until you're socialized with other children. And if this is a tradition of your family and this is how, you know, your parents are, what the behaviors that your parents are modeling for you, then mm-hmm. that's going to be the norm for you and it's going to be okay.
Yeah, I agree. I think it all comes down to what's happening in the family itself and also with that individual, how that individual has been treated over a period of time. And I think again, when you look at the level of, I think, the stress that people are under and people experience, when you have an opportunity to give to people and do other things, it always helps us to feel better about ourselves, too.
As you look at the images that we are most often presented with around Christmas, many of them are a lot more geared towards spending money and buying stuff than giving, at least in my perception. Now, it could easily be argued that you're spending money on something that you're giving. So I see the correlation. I see where it could be considered splitting hairs. Which one do you guys think, which message do you think is more prevalent? Is it the let's spend money, buy stuff, or is it the giving?
Again, I believe it depends on what culture you're in. And I don't mean culture as a whole. I mean, like, what's the culture in your family? What's the culture in your neighborhood? How have you been raised? You know, so it all depends. As a whole, what you see in the media is more so let's spend money, because it is, you know, retail driven. So it depends on, but then take it back a little bit. It depends on what you've been raised, how you've been raised in your household and your family, and what type of communication you guys have had growing up.
Yeah, you know, I think I would definitely agree with that. I think if we look at our society, if you just turn on television, now, when does the Christmas season begin? I remember at one time, you wouldn't start seeing a lot of advertisements for Christmas until like early November. And I believe I've heard people advertising and talking about Christmas around August or September of this year. So it seems like now the season to start encouraging people to buy items, it's been moved all the way out to August now. And so I think there's a lot of push, there's a lot of drive to encourage people to spend. There's a commercial that comes on and it's talking about give her like something from this jewelry store, let her know that you care, buy her diamonds, you know, make her silent, you know, take her breath away. So you have all these things that's encouraging to spend this money. But I think, again, it comes down to the individual family. The family sets the tone for what the holiday is going to be about. The family is always going to have outside influences coming in. But if mom and dad is there, whatever the family may be, that is where the tone for the holidays comes from.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I want to put something out here. And it's along the lines of, if there's anything I want folks to take from this show, it's the following. I was listening to a book on CD last year. It's called Selling You, and it's by Napoleon Hill. And one of the things he really promoted and said was that he spends a portion, and mind you, I haven't heard it in a year, so I'm doing my best to capture it. He spends a portion of each of his day simply helping someone else. He didn't say less fortunate, more fortunate, anything like that, but he literally will call upon someone and say, how can I help you today?
Mm-hmm.
I think that is an absolute beautiful sentiment, and it's one that I am committing to take into the new year, where I might call someone who it's simply in someone I haven't talked to in years that I've gotten my Rolodex and say, listen, I've got between 3 and 4 o'clock today. I've dedicated some time to helping someone else do whatever it is that they're trying to make happen today. How can I help you? Any thoughts on that?
I think that's absolutely great. You know, it goes down to the heart of it, though. Like, the core of it. That's the type of person that you are. And I think that's great. Helping others, helping other people. Some would say that's why we're here. You know, we're not here to live in this world alone. But as, you know, it was stated earlier, we are social beings. And some would say that this is the reason why we're here, to help other people, to help others fulfill their dreams or whatever it is that they want. However, I'm going to play devil's advocate with you, Frank, and say, now, what's the difference with you saying that I want to help someone else versus what you said earlier, your friend that on the 25th of December every year, his friend or he takes his son to, you know, help someone less fortunate. What's the difference in what you're saying versus that?
Thank you. I love it.
and you know, and I was actually thinking the same thing. I'm thinking, in this particular instance, you were saying that you were just going to do it at random, was from a Rolodex. And I noticed that all times you left out the words less fortunate. So it seems like you're parsecting people from being less fortunate in getting help with someone doing it randomly out of their heart seems to be more genuine. Again, is that how you're looking at it again, to kind of like play the devil advocate again?
Right. Kind of like it makes you feel better because it's random and it's, and you took out less fortunate. So what's the difference?
Well, I love you guys for even for going there. It goes to the heart of what I said the book was about, and it's called Selling You. So the real concept that he was embracing was, if you want to succeed, you help someone else succeed. And mm-hmm. I got to admit, I want to succeed.
Right. So when I think of selling you, it's, well, let me sell myself to other people by saying I want to help them and I want to help someone else. That makes me look better, or that gives the perception that I am a nice person, versus I'm doing this genuinely because I want to.
One of the premises of the book is, no matter what you're doing, if you're trying to make something happen, you're selling yourself. So if I am trying to build a building to help orphans, whoever I'm meeting with, whoever I'm working with, and that sort of thing, I am selling myself, because I'm selling my vision. I'm selling what I want to see happen. So yes, there is definitely a benefit that I get out of what I'm talking about, calling someone and saying, look, how can I help you today? There's absolutely no question in it.
But I think that even goes to the show. One of the things that you said in the introduction, I believe, is that you decided to wait till after the holidays to bring up this topic because you didn't want to be considered as a Scrooge.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and just think about that. Just that statement alone, that is an attempt to somehow manage your image and the impression that other people would get of you. But what difference does it make if it happens right now, after the holidays, or if this was a conversation before the holidays? Either way, what the conversation and the tone of the message that you're trying to get out is to get people to look at the act of giving itself. And are you giving because this is something that you want to do to help other people, or are you also going to receive something out of it? That's kind of like the message that I'm getting from this.
I absolutely agree.
You know, my pastor at church, he says, you know, our church is about giving, and we have this whole giving campaign, as I stated earlier. So he mentioned beforehand, when he saw someone on the street, he would say, okay, let me give them $5. However, you know, are they really going to buy food? Are they going to buy liquor? You know, what they going to do with my $5? However, he said he had to think about it and have a new insight on it and say, you know what, it doesn't matter what they're going to do with this $5. It's their money now. My job was to give, and that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to, you know, be a giver because this is something that I want to do. It doesn't matter what they do with it. It doesn't matter if they buy food, liquor, cigarettes, whatever. That's what they want to do with it, but my job is to give. And it's kind of like forgiveness, too. Like, forgiveness isn't for the other person. It's for you, mm-hmm. you know? So giving isn't for the other person. Yes, they benefit from it, but it's, you know, maybe it's selfish to think of it as it's for me, but you know, it doesn't matter what happens at the end of the day. I did my part and I gave.
You know, I agree with that 100%. Because think about it. If I was to pull up to an intersection and there's a homeless person standing there, if I can convince myself that this person is only going to take the money that I'm going to give them and go buy drugs and alcohol, when that light turns green, it's a whole lot easier for me to just hit the gas and drive off.
Mm-hmm.
However, if I truly believe that this couple of dollars I'm going to give this person would make that much of a difference, it becomes that much more difficult for me to look at that person and not do anything to help. I think we as people do not like to feel that we're helpless to help other people. And oftentimes when we see something like that, when people feel helpless to help someone, sometimes there's a tendency for us to get angry at the person who needs the help. And I think that's what happens when it comes to dealing with the homeless. People will get angry at the homeless and will rationalize our behavior. They really don't need my money. They're just going to go drinking. They're just going to go drugging. When in reality, we have no idea how needy that person may actually be.
You're listening to Frank Relationships, and we're talking with clinical psychologist Dr. George Stallings about issues around giving and Christmas. You mentioned addiction, and we've kind of talked about it, touched on it throughout the show. I was skimming through an article in a magazine that I believe is called Spirituality and Health, or Health and Spirituality, yesterday. And a gentleman was talking about how we are heavy on the concept of addiction because we're heavy upon ourselves and we have trouble forgiving and being compassionate to ourselves. But if we were more compassionate with ourselves, we wouldn't look at addiction as such a problem or as such a negative thing. Let me throw that to the two doctors in front of me. What do you guys have to say about that?
Say that last part again, Frank.
Well, addiction is not a bad thing. It's kind of what the article was going to. We all have them. They could be job related. It could be even exercises. A whole range of different things. But, I mean, generally when we talk about addiction, we're talking about substances, admittedly. He was saying that our reason for looking so down on those who are, quote unquote, addicted, it's reflective in how harsh we are on ourselves.
Well, and yes, I think it's a play on terminology because you could be addicted to certain things. However, let's just say coping, right? Some people cope with certain things, with drugs and alcohol, and some people cope with certain things with exercise or shopping and things of that nature. It depends on how you view it. If I view it as a coping mechanism, something that's positive, like working out or, you know, spending time with friends, journaling, reading a book, then from our point of view and society's point of view, then that's a positive coping mechanism. Wherein when you say addiction, I'm addicted to, I don't know, drugs, heroin, even shopping. That's a negative connotation, and it has a thought of I've lost control, so I have to use these substances in order to help me regain focus or, you know, get control of my life. When in actuality, you are in control.
Well, why isn't alcohol and smoking, why aren't those simply coping mechanisms?
They are coping mechanisms.
Because they're legal?
No, they are coping mechanisms, but they're negative coping mechanisms.
Well, I think, when we look at addiction itself, first, if we deal with addiction, let's look at people who sometimes would refer to themselves as the infamous adrenaline junkies. These are people that we see doing bungee jumping, doing snowboarding, motocross racing, and these people will suffer traumatic, life-threatening, or even life-ending injuries, but they will go to the hospital and they will get treatment if people say anything negative about them. However, you could take a same person who could be addicted to, say, heroin or cocaine. This person now, if they overdose, they are looked at much differently. I think when it comes to drug addiction, I think it's perceived more as a self-inflicted injury that could have been avoided. And because now you've decided to injure yourself with this drug, somehow I was under stress and I didn't use drugs. You were under stress and you've used drugs. So now
I'm better than you.
You have some type of moral character flaw about you. And when we can say that about a person, that makes it that much easier for us to say, well, this person doesn't really need treatment. But again, the example that I've used, you can have people who are engaging in addictive behavior, again, the people that like the extreme sports. They'll get injured. They're viewed as heroes and risk takers. But someone else who's using drugs, they're viewed as someone who has some type of moral failing about them.
And, you know, to take it a step further, really, one could argue that they shouldn't or they could be looked at as the same because both are, they use the same chemical compound in the brain, you know what I mean? Or you're getting the same
rush,
you know, the same synapses, you know, everything is being released similarly in the brain. It's just how you are seeking that thrill.
So,
yeah, I think, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go, Doc.
Yeah, I agree. I think that you're going to see the same thing. You're going to see the same sections, like the mesolimbic sixth section of the brain. You're going to see it become activated, engaging in that harvest behavior, as well as drug users. You're going to see more of the dopamine and the A1 receptors. You're going to see that playing a role, but society's reaction to it is much, much different. With one person, if a person is out snowboarding and they have an accident, you'll see people rushing in to help them, more of an altruistic behavior. But if you see someone who's OD'd and they passed out and they're lying on the sidewalk, or someone who may look like they've had too much methadone and they're standing there nodding out, how many people do you see to rush in and try to help that individual?
So do you, either of you, have a recommendation for those of us who, well, when talking to society in general about the comparison and the contrast between the two that we've just discussed?
You know, again, I think, to me, the way that I look at it, you have to first, I think, really, you have to understand what's going on with you. You have to understand the prism through which you're viewing the world, because if you don't understand many of the things that's influencing your thoughts and how you're understanding the world, then you're not going to be aware of biases or anything like that. And that's exactly what I come to. It comes down to the individual. You have to be able to understand you before you can understand anything else.
Right. And I completely agree. You have to understand your own worldview, and you have to, in a means, understand the other person's worldview as well. You know what I mean? And it's difficult because you can, you know, to say that you're going to come to someone's rescue or you're not going to come to someone's rescue, that's you projecting your worldview onto them, which, you know, when you're speaking of helping someone who OD'd on heroin or methadone or what have you, saying that I'm not going to help them because they did this to themselves, that's projecting your own worldview onto them. And in the end, you're not helping them.
Isn't there always someone who is willing to help someone, whatever the criteria is? You may not be interested in helping an addict, or you may not be interested in helping someone who participated in an extreme sport who is injured. But isn't there somebody out there who is? So
absolutely.
Is it worth leaving the person alone with the biases, or accepting that people have biases and not even judging them, but realizing that there's a balance in the world and that there's going to be someone who is going to step in and help that person no matter what?
Well, the way I look at it is this. We are all on our own journeys. You know, I didn't wake up today at this stage of my life. It took me a slow process to get there. And I think one of the things that it's important to do is to recognize that everybody is in a different place in the world. We all are not at the same place. And it's okay. It doesn't make me any better. It doesn't make me any worse. It's just recognizing that this is where this person is and maybe their stage of moral development. And that's fine for them. That's where they are right now.
And, you know, when we're taught in school and in training, you have to learn with what you can live with. What types of clients can you work with, and what type of people can't you live with and can't you work with? You know what I mean? If you can't work with the person that is addicted to methadone, but you can work with the person that's addicted to shopping and spending money, then so be it. You do not want to inflict your own biases and your own worldview onto someone else, because in the end, you won't be helping them. You'll be hindering them, and you know, you'll be, as I stated, putting your own views onto them.
You've been listening to Frank Relationships. We've been talking with clinical psychologist Dr. George Stallings about issues pertaining to Christmas, as Americans tend to celebrate it, and that are rarely discussed. Along today's journey, we've discussed the psychology of giving, if we're spending money or giving, and teaching children about Christmas, giving, receiving, all of that good stuff. I hope you've had as much fun as I've had talking with Dr. Stallings about the often undiscussed issues pertaining to Christmas. As always, it's my wish for you to walk away from this conversation with a heaping helping of useful information that will help you create a relationship that's as loving and accepting as possible. Let us know what you thought of today's show at Facebook/RelationshipFLove, on Twitter at Mr., that's MR, Frank Love, or at franklove.com. Until next time, keep rising. This is Frank Love.